Well, when it comes to not getting turned down on your worship team, one of the biggest problems is that the people on the worship team end up turning each other off, and the sound person doesn't even have to do it, or is trying desperately not to do it, but we're doing it to ourselves. So let's fix it. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back. My name is Stephen Reed. I am part of the team here at Music and Ministry, and we are in this just gigantic dive now into what it is and what it takes to not get turned down on your worship team, because unfortunately, that is the reality in most places. And if you haven't been following along, I would encourage you to go back and watch all the episodes that we've done so far. We've been trying to do this sequential thing where we're, you know, presenting some points and building on them and moving forward. But today we're going to circle back to an idea that we have talked quite a bit about, which is going to be adapting our recordings for a live performance. And that is a huge aspect of success in a worship team, because we do most everything that we do based on these recordings. And as I've mentioned throughout the course of time here, those recordings have a lot of value. There's a lot of things that we can learn from them. But they have a big fault, a big problem in that it's not the exact same thing. And so just like a movie is not the same thing as a play, which is not the same thing as a book, which is not the same thing as ice capades, those things all might be the exact same story, but yet we have to adapt each one for the different environment. And the mistake that most worship teams make is that they try to emulate a live recording, quote unquote, in their services, but yet it's not the same stuff. It's not the same audience. It's not the same system. There's just so much different. We have to adapt those things. Now, unfortunately, most people don't know how to do that, have not been trained how to do that. And so when they go, they may not even be aware that they need to do that. And so they just end up causing a lot of problems, having a lot of failures, and then being frustrated by those things. So that's part of what we're trying to do here today, is get through some of those things and help you and train you and make you aware of some things. So we've talked a little bit about how to make that conversion from our recording to our live environment. And we've talked about how we most of the time are going to be dealing with a mono environment versus a stereo environment, and how we need to start cutting out the different parts that are involved in the worship team. And we played the game, which I would encourage you to play at your church or wherever it is you are, where you get a multi-track, you force mono, or you put it in the stereo system that it is that you're using at your church, and then you start to turn on and off the tracks and try to see if you can hear it or if you can't hear it. And when we do that, as we did in our video a few weeks ago, then you start to realize, oh, I don't need that part. I don't need seven guitars. I need one guitar. Or I could cover these parts in two guitars. Or I don't need eight keyboards and all these other things. Or we listened to one song that had this huge less string section and you couldn't hear a single note of it. Well, you can cut those things out. You don't need to try and replicate that in your live environment. You'll save yourself a lot of time and a lot of frustration, because there's just too much sound being fit into a small area that is our live environment. So I often say that almost every worship team is struggling because they have too much sound. I know that seems crazy, and I say a lot of crazy things here on this program, but it's true. And what we end up having is these sound people that are trying to desperately find clarity by carving all of these spaces in the sonic spectrum so that each instrument has a place. And there's all of these sound things that you can do with equipment and tips and tricks. And sometimes it's a little bit of manipulation. Or we can fix it with our orchestration. And I tend to be able to do both, because I've spent a lot of time in sound and have done a lot of recording things and live sound, but I also have done a lot of work with orchestrating and being on worship teams and being environments where we don't have all of that equipment. And so then you have to figure out, okay, if I don't have this equipment, how am I going to do the same thing, get the same sound? Okay, there's two different ways to do it. And so I am always a fan of doing it the orchestrational way, meaning that we fix the problem at its source versus spending a lot of time, money, and energy and possibly manipulation to try and fix something that was bad to begin with. And so sometimes people have control over the orchestration and sometimes people don't. And a lot of times, as we've talked about, the sound person generally has no authority to talk to the musicians, to talk with the worship leader and say, hey, can we fix this here? Or maybe they just don't even understand that that's possible. And so that it ends up being kind of an us and them relationship where the sound person just does whatever they're going to do and the band does whatever they're going to do. There's no conversations in between. And again, that ends up in a lot of manipulation and deception to some extent. So we got to fix that problem. That's one of the issues we've been talking about as far as developing that tether to the reality that is that sound person, opening up communication systems. How do we get the right people in place to do that communication between the different entities there? And that's really the most important thing. Like, if you can get those people to work together and to find ways to hear what the sound person is hearing, then you'll start making the same decisions in the sense of, ah, that needs to change, or we need to do something different. And then hopefully I'll be able to give you the tools that you'll need to be able to fix whatever it is that's going wrong. And so I'm often conflicted because I do know how to fix some of those things, fix, quote unquote, with the technology and with the manipulation and just using some of the bad systems that people use a whole lot. But that's not the best. And it's wasting people's time where we could fix it from this other way. So I would definitely encourage you. I'm going to describe some techniques today, and I don't want you to go out and be like, oh, he described this. I'm going to do this, this, and this. No, I want you to open up lines of communication between your group. I want you to figure out these things so that way you don't have to fix it. That would be the best. That would make my heart happy at the end of the day. So one of the major things is what I want to talk to today is that we have to adapt our recordings to our live by playing fewer notes. And so I made the statement before that if you go and learn how to play the song exactly like they play it on the recording, say you watch a playthrough video maybe online, or maybe you subscribe to something like worshipartistry.com. They don't pay me anything to promote them, but they do a great job of figuring out what they played on the recording and then showing you how to play that. And you would think, oh, if I play exactly what they played on the recording and we all got together, it's going to sound great. And the answer is no. There will still be people who will be getting turned off or will be buried by each other, because those services and that information that they're putting out there online is to play it like the recording. And live sound is not like a recording. It's like live sound. And so we have to make that adaptation. And one of the biggest things is yes, we have to eliminate a lot of different people because we don't have the same amount of sonic space, but then we also need to play fewer notes. We need to make sure that we're not playing the same note. And so what that means is that if I play the same note as somebody else, well, in a stereo environment, I can put that one note on my right side and I can put that other note on my left side and I still can hear both because I have this extra space to fill. Well, in a monitor environment, those sounds are right on top of each other. And so the only way that you get heard is by being louder than somebody. And so it ends up then being what I call the volume war, where the only way you can tell who is playing the note is by which one's louder. And that is not a good place to be. So what we need to then do is not play the same notes. And that, I know, again, is another crazy statement because, again, you're going to get the music, you're going to watch the lesson, and they'll be like, this is where you play and this is what you do. And I'm like, yeah, if you have all of those other things in place, which you don't, so let's make some adaptation. So before we dive into the specifics, the general rule is don't play the same notes as other people. And that's going to take some retraining. It's not something you've probably heard before, but it's definitely important. And if you don't do it on your own, then the sound person is going to start slicing and dicing you to where even if you are playing that note and it sounds good in your headphones, it's not making it out of the main sound system. They're basically turning parts of you off. And that has a lot of issues later on, but that's standard practice for most sound people, because they're trying to gather some clarity in a world where people are doing the exact same thing as everybody else, and then trying to figure out how do we get some separation. So let's make our separation on our own. The classic one I've mentioned a few times would be the war between the bass player and the pinky of the piano player, because they often play the exact same note. And so if you were to play a normal G chord on the piano, your pinky would be on the G, and if you're super cool, you're going to go down to that low octave, and you maybe you're going to do octaves here with between your pinky and your thumb, and you're going to be playing a G and a G. Well, if you were to ask the bass player, which G are you playing? They're going to be playing one of the exact same ones, and basses and pianos have a very similar sound, and so then the sound person then has to choose which one of those am I going to pick, and depending on what their preferences are as sound people, what you guys like as a church, whether or not they're married to the bass player potentially. You never know the situation there. they're going to choose one of them. And what often happens is that from a sound system perspective, a soundboard perspective, they're going to cut off the bass player, as we've talked quite a bit, and they're going to make it to where all we can hear is that one note. We can't even hear you plucking the string anymore. All we can hear is this, the sound of that note. They're going to do what's called a low-pass filter or a high cut. It's going to be super deep. And so they're going to say, this is the area that you get to play in, bass player. Anything else, you're just up there making it for a show. This is all you get. And then what they'll go over to then is the piano. And on the EQ, they're going to apply another cut. But this time, they're going to cut off the piano from the low end to the high end, which we would call a high pass filter or a low cut filter. And they're basically going to say, piano player, you basically get your finger cut off. You cannot play notes that are below that. Even if they do play that note, which they do quite a bit, and because they just turned off those sounds, sometimes they'll play it even louder, hoping to get some sound out of there. But the reason is because that piano player can't bring themselves to, or doesn't know how to not play that note that the bass player is playing, even though that's what they learned on the tutorial, even that's what they showed on the official walkthrough on whatever channel it is that you watched, that's the live conversion that the sound person is having to try to make for you. And so we basically are carving out these little sections for each instrument based on our inability to recognize that we're covering what everybody else is doing, even though we feel like, oh, we need more sound, we need more instruments. And the answer is no, we don't. We need to use what we're doing a little bit better. All right. Now, that sounds good for the most part, as long as both instruments are playing. What then happens is if the bass player is out for a section of the song and we want the full sound of the piano, maybe the third song is a more of a piano driven song, well, now the piano doesn't sound super great on its own because it's got part of the sound is missing from our EQ adjustment that we made. Well, now we've got a problem, but hey, we could throw on some more technology, spend some more money, some more time and effort. There is a way that you can actually connect the bass player and the keyboard player through a thing called sidechaining that will then recognize when the bass player is playing, whenever it hits a note, it will turn on that filter to where it can't hear the low sound. And then as soon as the bass player stops playing, that filter will come off and then it'll be a normal piano. And so I just described to you a very long process of things that have to be done and put into balance and equipment that you have to have, all because we just want the keyboard player to not use their pinky on the same note that the bass player is playing, and we need the bass player to not be so busy with their plucking fingers. This problem could be solved in a very short conversation versus spending a whole lot of time and money to try and fix something that can be done relatively easily. All right, those are the kind of things. All right, so then as we continue across the sonic spectrum from our low to our high, we're gonna run into all of these different places where different instruments start to live. And so the next one's gonna be the acoustic guitar or possibly the electric guitar. And if the keyboard or electric guitar is playing the same note as an acoustic guitar, the acoustic guitar is a very fragile instrument, sonically speaking. And so it's gonna get washed out very quickly. And you're like, why can't I hear that acoustic guitar? And then when everybody else stops playing, oh, there it is, it sounds good. That's also part of the reasons why, if you remember those days when people used to have floor monitors, right? And then you would have people always ask, hey, can I get a little bit more? Can I get a little bit more? And then everybody would stop playing and they would play their instrument. They're like, oh, that's much better. Thank you. And then you as the sound person didn't even get a chance to get your fingers up to find which one of the 1,000 buttons it was to turn it up. And you're like, wait a minute, I didn't. And then you start to realize, oh, wait a minute, they didn't actually need an adjustment. There's something else happening. And so that's what we then refer to as the ghost turn. And so sound people will then, from the rest of the time, put their finger up like they're making an adjustment, be like, is that better? Is that better? And then most of the time, if not 90 to 100% of the time, people are like, oh yeah, that's better, thank you. And it becomes this weird manipulation where it's like, I'm not actually making the adjustments that you want me to because there's some other issue. We don't know what's actually wrong, but I know it's not that you need more volume. But we end up having so much stage volume because everybody's covering each other's notes. Everybody's just getting louder and louder and louder to the point where at some churches I've been to, the mains aren't even on. All the sound that you're hearing is coming from the monitors. Why? Because we haven't trained people how to mix their monitors. And then we're all covering each other's sounds, so we can't hear each other even though we're playing louder and louder and louder. All right, so if we fix, don't play the same note. So if you're an electric player and you're playing all six of your strings all the time, guaranteed you're making mistakes. And you're like, well, again, that's what they did in the recording. Doesn't matter. You gotta make some space for your friends. And I sometimes will use the illustration of like a photo. And if you're trying to take a group photo, well, you can't just like everybody run up to the front and take the whole photo. You got to find a way to like fit in and get a whole group. And if I was to try to fit my whole family in this frame, well, I can't stand here and be as big and as in the forefront here. I'm going to have to step back. I'm going to turn sideways, have my family. Well, we're going to have to squeeze in here in order for us all to fit. Well, because we don't have the right perspective, we're not looking at what the camera's looking at, which would be, in our illustration, the sound person or what's coming out of the mains. In our world, we all have our own individual camera that we're looking at. And so then I look at my camera and I say, oh, I look good. And then I push click. But then I'm like, the other four people or three people are doing that in my family. Well, we all may think that we're looking good, but nobody's seeing what we're seeing with our cameras. They're only seeing what's going on in that one. And if we don't make those proper adjustments, then we just have a lot of whoever is the favorite musician of the sound person or is the pastor or pastor's wife or whatever that would happen to be. And that happens so much that it's why I'm making these videos, because it's frustrating. All this time, all this energy, potential being wasted because we haven't figured these things out. All right, so from the standpoint of a guitar, you should not be playing all of your strings. So if you're acoustic guitar, you're going to either be aiming low in the sense you're going to play your bottom three strings, or you're going to be aiming high playing your top three strings. And depending on which ones you're playing, you're going to play differently. With your bottom strings, you'll most likely be changing chords. And with your top three strings, sometimes you don't even follow the chord progression because you're just playing maybe ones and fives of the key. So if you were in the key of G, you would be playing G, D, and G, and you can play those three notes over every single chord and they sound good. And you're like, well, why aren't you following the chord progressions? Because we don't need you to follow the chord progression, because other people are doing that for you and we're working together to make this collective sound, all right? I know I'm just throwing crazy statements out there, but those are the kind of things and adjustments that we need to make in order for you to hear the instruments that are up there on the stage. All right, so the same thing goes if you're an electric player, and if the acoustic guitar player is playing low, then electric player, you would be playing high. You would be playing either your top two strings, maybe your top three strings, and then sometimes you're gonna bring that all the way up an octave. You're gonna be playing past the 12th fret, because then that puts you in this next area, this range, which sometimes doesn't have a whole lot going on in it, because the piano player is playing usually close to each other in parallel octaves, where there's just, you know, continuous notes all the way up as far as their 10 fingers can go. They're going to play those notes. Well, there's room on the top for someone to play a lead line. And if you're playing that lead line in the same place where they have their right hand, well, now we're back in the volume war. And who's going to win out? It all depends on who's stronger, who has maybe a stronger personality and can sway the sound person again. All right. And the sound person, again, is going to make a choice, or will start carving out that sound, or will eventually just bury you and turn you off completely. So that all being said, you basically have to do what I call playing thin, meaning take what you would normally do and usually cut it in half in the sense of the amount of notes that you're playing. So you're going to play, usually I would say for a keyboard player, you're going to play one-handed, meaning you're going to either play here or you're going to play here. Sometimes I will give my piano player an extra note, but you're going to be playing two or three notes, and you would not use your low pinky to play that root note because that's what the bass player is playing. Now, obviously, if the bass player is not in at that moment, then yes, play that note. But as soon as they come in, you got to lift that finger up. You got to adjust for them and then work together. All right. If you've got some other kind of instrument going on, you definitely have to carve in space. If you got a violin, you got a flute player, whatever it happened to be, you can't be all playing the notes that that person's supposed to play. Otherwise, somebody is going to get turned down, and it may just be you. Depends. All right, the last one that I'll talk today is the biggest one. By far the most important is because that's the thing that we're there to do, which is to get people to sing, to get them to worship to the Lord. And so when we come down to, are we playing the same note as what the singers are singing or are supposed to be singing? If we're playing that note, the singers are going to win most of the time, depending on your style of your church. Now, on the recording, you will listen, and if you go to the multi-tracks and listen, you will hear the background singers singing particular notes. And in a recording setting, most background singers are quite a bit lower than they are in a live setting. Most churches prefer to have a more heavy vocal mix, and so they'll mix those background vocals much more heavy. And so, again, if we're playing the same notes that the vocalists are singing, well, then we start to get into that volume war with our vocalists, and the sound person is most likely going to choose the vocalist over the instrumentalist. And I cannot tell you how many churches I have been to where the piano player is just cranking out that note that the vocalists are singing, and they're getting turned down as a whole, because it takes a lot of understanding for a sound person to realize, oh, that's what's happening. They're playing that same note. And there is a way that you could go in with your EQ graph or with some other form of compression or side change thing, that if the vocalist was singing, it would do a little dip in the middle of wherever that note is on the sonic spectrum, and it would turn those notes down, keeping the other notes up. But that's very complicated. And again, most people don't even recognize that that's the actual problem of what's happening. And so if you're playing the same note that the vocalists are singing, you're most likely going to get turned down and potentially, as we learned last week, get left down for a period of time. So you got to make sure that you're leaving a hole, that you're punching a hole sonically in your orchestration, so that way the vocals can be heard. All right, now that's true for the main vocal for sure. All right, so whatever the melody is, you want to make sure that you're not playing that note, or at least not a lot of people are playing that note. Now, if you've got harmony singers, that means you're going to have notes potentially on either side of that melody note that you're going to want to also make room for, because otherwise you as an instrumentalist are going to be turning down the background singers because you're playing the same note that they're trying to sing. All right. Now, that is for what I would call modern contemporary praise and worship. There is an exact opposite of what I just told you that is sometimes the thing to do if you're trying to lead. Hymns are designed this way, where the instrument is actually playing the melody line of what the person is singing. And so the person is singing, the instrument is playing, and it's a way to help people know, hey, this is what the melody is, because a lot of times you're doing a brand new song each week, hymn each week, and so people didn't memorize each of those hymns. They had the skill of reading music, and so they would look at the notes that are in the hymnal, and they would sing along, and then you would get some help from an instrument plucking out that melody line for you so you could learn it quicker. That is not how modern praise and worship is orchestrated. People aren't doing that. It's usually just people pounding away, adding rhythm where they don't need to add rhythm, or there's just so many people playing that same note that they're turning each other off, and then they're getting turned off because we're going to let the vocalist win. So what you're going to do this week, or should do this week, or whenever it is that you watch this, you should go through and find out how many notes you have duplicated, and you're going to find out it's significant, all right? And so then you just have to start deciding who is going to play what note. Now, if you just make this change, you're going to find that it instantly sounds a whole lot clearer. And you might also think, well, now it sounds a little empty because we are used to having such this full sound of people, you know, more sound than we knew what to do with. And so this is kind of an interesting point in the transitionary process of adapting from recording to live, is that most live sound people are desperately trying to get some clarity because there's too much sound. And so now, because there's going to be the right amount of sound coming out, we actually have to start undoing all of the things that we've tried to do to fix the problem that we have now fixed with our orchestration. So instead of slicing off parts of the instrument, we're going to let them have that back. So that's a freeing moment. And I've been the person who got to do that with teams and be like, all right, no more high-pass filter on the piano. No more low-pass filter on the bass guitar. And you're like, wait a minute, you mean I get to play these higher notes? Or they go to hit the keyboard, and they're like, oh, wow, that's there. I didn't even know I could get it back. And it's like, yeah, well, we're trusting you here, right? Is that if the bass player's playing, you don't play that note, then I'm going to leave that off, and you have the freedom to do it. And if they don't do it, then I kind of raise my hand and be like, hey, can you move your left hand up an octave? And they'll be like, oh, yeah, that's right. And that's what we want. We want freedom for the instruments to be able to do what it is that sounds good, but they got to be able to work together. And as we've talked about, all these things are integrated. They have to be in a system that allows them to work together. So you got to work on your monitoring. You got to work on your communication skills between your sound person and your team in order to make all this happen, because it's almost impossible if you don't fix those other things, because how would you know whether or not it's working together? If you don't even have those people on in your headphones, how can you know if they're playing or not playing, which is sadly the case for most people. It's a lot to take in, but once you fix those things, once you recognize that's the actual problem, you're gonna fix it, and then you're gonna be well on your way to making the music that you want to, doing what you want to as a ministry, and the Lord Jesus will be honored and glorified. It's gonna be great, and my heart will be happy wherever I am in the time that you figure it out. It's gonna be great.